All right, so let me start the last lecture. So 2 days ago, we started discussing phase transitions from a microscopic point of view. And so basically, the idea is that the matter organizes itself into various phases. And so you can have phase transitions from one phase to another. And this will be typically described by the same Hamiltonian. So for example, the Ising model is described by this Hamiltonian here. But the same Hamiltonian, the same microphysics can actually result in different phases and different macrophysics. Okay, so we will have ferromagnetic phase, which certainly has different macrophysical properties than the paramagnetic phase for this thing. Okay, and so as we shall see in a minute, it's typically, you know, the new phases are distinguished by, for example, ordering. So if we have a ferromagnet, we will have ordered spins, you know, in that ferromagnet, and that will result in some non-trivial overall magnetization. Okay, so to understand phase transitions and, you know, the microscopics of these, I think this is really a canonical example, is the Ising model of a ferromagnetic phase transition. And it goes all the way to 1920, and the first solution in 1D was 1925. And you basically derived it yesterday in the tutorial, although you didn't have the magnetic field. There is also a solution with the magnetic field, and there is a nice trick how to obtain that solution, but what we will not need that. So anyway, so the model is very simple. I just have a d-dimensional cubic lattice, and so on that lattice, I have discrete spins, spin variables, and they are simply, the spins are only up and down. Okay, so I don't have any rotational freedom or whatever. That would be a different model of ferromagnetism. It would be called Heisenberg's model or vector model. But in this case, I just really, each spin has only value up or down. Okay, and so this is the corresponding Hamiltonian. And so you have two spin interactions. And so basically, in principle, you can interact each spin with many neighbors. Typically, what people consider is that they take the spin I and they only consider the nearest neighbors, which are these four here in two-dimensional lattice. But then you could consider the next nearest neighbor. So you would consider this one, this one, this one, this one as well. But also, you can keep going. But of course, what you assume typically is that there is a finite range of interaction. So actually, you only interact with several nearest neighbors, but not with all spins in the lattice, okay? So typically, you assume some properties on these interaction coefficients Jij. Of course, these Jij matrix is symmetric because sigma I, sigma j is, and so it doesn't make sense to consider Jij non-symmetric. All right, so now people spend lots of time trying to solve this model, which is like really toy model of ferromagnetism. And one of the reasons is that people believe that basically, although this may be too naive to describe really ferromagnetism, whatever, then it's precisely what people believe it describes, transitions of water. Okay, so in three dimensions, if you can solve this, you can actually understand water. And that's good. All right, so now let me continue this, unless there are questions. Okay, so the statement is that this Ising model admits two phases, and is the ferromagnetic one or the paramagnetic one, and they differ by the overall magnetization. So let's define the magnetization to be an average of sigma I, which is nothing else, if you want, than sigma I divided by n. So I sum over all possible spins, and then I divide by the number of sides. And this is either zero, which is the paramagnetic phase, or it's non-zero. It's non-zero, and that's the ferromagnetic one. So the statement is how this looks like. If I plot this M with respect to the temperature, then for sufficiently high temperatures, you will be in the paramagnetic phase. So you'll be somewhere here. So it's simply the magnetization is equal to zero. But there will be some critical temperature, TC, at which you start developing a non-trivial magnetization. And what is And I say, well, this model is that this is a continuous phase transition. So basically, you start here from the zero, and then you go like that, and this will be your magnetization. So at t equal to zero, all spins will be organized into, you know, let's say, all spins will be sort of pointing up at t equal to zero. And then, of course, if I keep increasing the temperature, there will always be some spins which are down as well. Okay, so that's how the picture looks like. So at t equal to zero, all spins are aligned. But if p is bigger than zero, then we have thermal fluctuations. Thermal fluctuations, and you know, some spins will always be down. Okay, so that does not mean actually. So if you are at finite temperature, t bigger than zero, it doesn't mean that always the same spin are up and always the same spin are down. Of course, because of the thermal fluctuations, each spin here actually fluctuates, and you know, it flips down, flips up, flips down, flips up. But in average, you know, there will be, you know, that many spins up and that many spins down, and there's more spins up, say, so that's why I have non-trivial magnetization. But you know, each spin is actually does fluctuate, and so each spin can flip up and down. But it's very unlikely that if you have 1,000 spins up and 10 spins down, that you know, you will suddenly swap this thing. So swapping 1,000 spins which were up, down, and 10 spins up only is very improbable. Okay, and that is why actually going from plus magnetization to minus magnetization here is very unlikely, because you have large number of spins. Okay, so flipping from here to there is very unlikely, because you would have to flip 1,000 spins at one moment down, but only 10 spins up. Okay? So now this is a continuous phase transition, because at this point where actually something non-trivial starts happening, that point is called critical point. So this is a critical point. And at that critical point, the magnetization is actually continuous. So magnetization is something which you should be considering as the order parameter here. So really, I start ordering my spins up. Okay, so at this point, the magnetization is continuous. And that's why this type of phase transition, where the order parameter, so magnetization can be thought as the order parameter, so phase transitions where the order parameter is continuous at the critical point are called continuous phase transitions. So we have continuous phase transition. And in the Enfest classification, the thermodynamic classification, this would correspond to second order phase transitions and higher. Okay, so second order phase transition. Or higher. Why is it so? Because you know, we classified according to the free energy, but the magnetization is actually derivative of the free energy. So we are saying that the derivative of the free energy is continuous, and so that's why we have second order phase transition, or higher one. So now people laugh, well, physicists laugh, second order and you know, higher order phase transitions. And the reason why they love them is that they demonstrate some kind of nice behavior. So if you consider first order phase transition, so first order would look like my order parameter would suffer from a jump. So you would have a critical temperature here, and let's say you would have zero here. And so this is how a first order would look like. You would have a finite jump at Tc. So now many phase transitions in the nature are first order phase transitions. For example, liquid gas phase transition is a first order phase transition. Okay, so many more phase transitions in the nature are first order. So these are quite, you know, common. So now you may be asking, well, what the hell, why people are interested in these continuous phase transitions? And the reason is that each first order phase transition is sort of different. So there is no common language for these phase transitions. So you just know that there will be a jump in the order parameter. Well, again, this is the order parameter, which jumps here. But there is nothing nice about these first common, but not nice. Meaning each of them you have to study separately. However, if you have a continuous phase transition, then at least in the vicinity of this critical point, all of the continuous phase transitions look very similar. What I mean by that, more precisely, you will see later today, is that they are described by the same critical exponents. Okay, so on the other hand, the continuous phase transitions, these transitions are nice. People say that they are universal. They have some kind of universal behavior. And what I mean by universal behavior is that in the vicinity of the critical point, they look very much alike. So if you look at the physics close to the critical point, so this is my critical point here. Well, that's my critical point. So near this critical point, you can study what various physical quantities do. And so these physical quantities behave in the same way for all continuous phase transitions. And so that's what it means that the phase transition is universal. And so what I mean by behave the same way, means that they are characterized by critical exponents. And so what I mean by that is, so for example, you may look at the specific heat close to the phase transition. And so for example, e.g. the specific heat and what you will find is that for continuous phase transitions, the specific heat C simply behaves like parameter T, which I will define what it is, to some critical exponent alpha. So this is the critical exponent alpha, and T is simply how close in temperature you are close to the critical temperature. So this is T minus TC divided by TC, I hope. let me see, that's the definition I'm using. T minus TC divided by TC. So you'll find that, you know, close to the critical point, the specific heat, and alpha is typically positive, so it goes like 1 over T to some power alpha, which is positive, so the specific heat actually diverges around the critical point. So if you have TC here, the specific heat will diverge like that, and that will be true for every continuous phase transition, okay? So that's what it means, they are universal. But it's even better than that, actually. It turns out that the systems which have nothing to do with each other, like water and ferromagnet, okay, they actually turn out to have the same critical exponents. So the systems which look very much different, you know, microscopically and whatever, they tend to have the same critical exponent, alpha and the other critical exponents for other physical quantities. And you know that's why they are super nice, these phase transitions. So there are systems. So universality really means that systems with completely different, oh, let's say, completely different systems, completely different systems may have the same critical exponents. And if this happens, then you say that the two systems, for example, water and ferromagnet, they belong to the same universality class. They are in the same universality class. And of course, this was super exciting for physicists, right? Why should water and ferromagnet behave exactly the same way close to the critical point, right? And that, so that demands an explanation. And also, of course, what you would like also to do is to predict what these critical exponents actually are from theory, right? So you not only want to show why they are the same for different systems, but also you want to calculate what these critical exponents are. And that led to a normalization group and so on. Okay, so this is really, you know, super exciting. Why continuous phase transitions are actually interesting. All right, so let me also stress one point here, is that when we discuss these continuous phase transitions, then we are saying something really for physicists which is completely unacceptable, right? So we are saying that the magnetization as a function of some parameter temperature, well, is zero in this region and it's non-trivial in that region. So in other words, it's non-analytic behavior. So the magnetization shows non-analytic behavior in temperature. And you know, that took physicists a long time to understand, because everything in physics is analytic, right? So you always have analytic functions, you always have differentiability and so on, but here you don't. Okay, so remark, or maybe let's make several remarks. So first, note the non-analytic behavior of M. And of course, we know that this actually means that the free energy has to be non-analytic in temperature, right? So how that can happen, you know, in physics? Why? You know, when everything is analytic, right? So non-analytic behavior. And that really took a lot of time for people to understand why non-analytic behavior can emerge in physics. Another remark is that if you look at your Hamiltonian here, so that has some symmetry. Can you guess what that symmetry could be?
Lorentz symmetry?
What? Lorentz symmetry?
I said O-N symmetry, but no. It's
O-N symmetry.
Dimensions, parity symmetry. Shift everything.
Exactly. Ah, very good. So it doesn't have Lorentz symmetry. It doesn't have O-N symmetry. But it has, I can flip every spin to a minus spin. Okay.
It has a O-1 symmetry, right? That's O-1 symmetry.
No, it's not. So if I flip each spin here to its opposite, but I do it everywhere in the lattice, of course the Hamiltonian will be the same, because the Hamiltonian is quadratic. So if I go from sigma I to minus sigma I, so there's a symmetry here. And the symmetry is simply I go from sigma I to minus sigma I everywhere. If I do that, I have the same Hamiltonian. So that's not O-1 symmetry, but it's Z2 symmetry.
O-1 and Z2 are the same group.
Are they?
Yeah. O-1 is the group 1 minus 1.
Symmetry. O-1. Maybe. Are they? Okay, you know, much better. Okay, so there's a Z2 symmetry here. And so now what's actually happening, so that's the symmetry of the Hamiltonian, right? So that's the symmetry of this guy. But if you look at the ordered phase here, if you look at the magnetization as a function of temperature, I'm plotting the magnetization with a plus sign here. I'm not plotting it with a minus sign. The question is why? Why I cannot plot magnetization with a minus sign here? Can I? Can I plot a similar picture like this? Well, from the symmetry of the Hamiltonian, I should be able to, right? So the symmetry of the Hamiltonian tells me, well, it just, you know, I can flip all the spins. So if I have a solution which admits magnetization up, I should have a solution which admits a magnetization down, right? And this is indeed the case. So why I was plotting only the first one? What do you think? It's because in the phase transition, you break this symmetry, okay? And so basically, and there is a special term for how you break this symmetry, is that you randomly choose up or down. Basically, the system chooses randomly up or down and orders itself either into up or into down. Of course, the probability 1/2, which one you choose, okay? So this symmetry is spontaneously broken in the ferromagnetic phase. So basically, the system randomly chooses, I want to be up or I want to be down. And then, you know, if it chooses up, then this is the right picture. If it chooses down, then I should be plotting the other picture. Okay. So that's another key term. So you basically spontaneously break the symmetry. And so you start developing the order parameter, which is the magnetization. So this spontaneously broken symmetry is related precisely to the existence of the order parameter. So only if I break the symmetry, I can actually have the order parameter. I can have non-trivial magnetization. Okay, what else? So now, let me make this a little bit more clear by doing a very simple exercise. So let's switch on the magnetic field into this model, okay? And then, of course, if you switch on the magnetic field, let's say I put magnetic field in the, you know, up direction, then of course one of these should be preferred, right? Because I want to minimize the energy. So in that case, if I have external magnetic field, this one or that one will be preferred depending on the direction of the magnetic field. Okay, so let's do a simple exercise. Let's do an exercise, which is, you know, switch on magnetic field. B, and let's consider a finite system and consider finite size system that means I have n number of sides and n is finite. Okay, so I have n number of spins, and then now I put this in an external magnetic field. And so the Hamiltonian now just picks any, so of course the Hamiltonian will be this Hamiltonian plus an interaction term with the magnetic field, which is simply B times sigma. Okay, so then the Hamiltonian just minus 1/2 sum over I and j, jij, sigma I, sigma j, and then minus B times sum over sigma I. So that's the interaction with the magnetic field. Okay. And so let's say we start with B positive, and then let's just ask what is the probability of finding magnetization smaller than zero versus the probability of finding magnetization bigger than zero. And let's consider the simplest possible case that let's compare the probability that all spins are up with respect to the probability that all spins are down. Okay, so then the probability of finding all spins up versus down. Okay, so then for this we can, well, let's assume that we can use the Boltzmann distribution. So the Boltzmann distribution is that the probability of finding something is E is exponential of minus beta E, where E is the energy of the system. Okay, so then if you want, so let's compare the two. So it's probability magnetization is this one versus probability magnetization is that one. But I'm only interested in all spins up or all spins down. Okay, and so you want to evaluate the energy corresponding to this Hamiltonian, and exponential of that minus beta energy gives you the probability. So now this is the Boltzmann distribution. And so in one case, if I have, so what I'm considering is that beta, that B is positive. So the energy evaluated by this term here will be the same for spins up or spins down. Okay? So if I have all spins up or all spins down, this thing, this part of the Hamiltonian gives exactly the same thing. But this thing will be different because this is fixed, and now I have spins up or spins down. So this will be different. And so this is simply given. So now I maybe talk too much, and the result is super simple. So the sum just gives me N because I have all spins aligned, and then B, and then the magnetization divided by T, and then here it will be the same thing but plus NBM over T. Okay, so this is what it is. So in other words, it is E to minus 2NBM over T. Okay, so that's the ratio of the probability of being then down or being then up. And it's simply that because only the second term in the Hamiltonian contributes. Okay, so this is what it is. So now let's consider two cases. Let's take a limit of this. One where I take, well, I want to take a limit where I take the magnetic field goes to zero. And I want to take the limit when I take the number of sites, the number of spins goes to infinity. So naively, you would again think in physics that these two limits commute. But they don't, okay? So let me take first the limit where I say, so two limits. So first limit is that I take n finite and send b to zero. So if you take that the number of sides is finite and you switch off the magnetic field, well, of course, I'm plugging there zero, so e to zero is one. So then the ratio is one. So the ratio is one. So in other words, you know, if I switch off the magnetic field, then actually finding all the spins up is equally probable to finding all the spins down. Okay? So that's what we just calculated. So in other words, you know, and of course you can think about probability, roughly speaking, about like a time evolution of the system. So in principle, if I consider super long times, okay, then I will find, you know, half of the time the system will be up, half of the time the system will be down. So basically, what happens here is that over long time, both states are equally probable or are equally happening. So if I have a finite system, then indeed I'm finding, of course, this will not be really true at t equals zero, but anywhere else, I'm finding that this magnetization is equally probable as that magnetization. And so, you know, after some time, even though, you know, the system was here, I can actually flip all the spins down or whatever and have the system here. And then flip back and then whatever. So I will have equally probable both things. And so if you want an average over the magnetization over all time, then the average magnetization is zero because I am equally up or equally down. So average M in this case is actually equal to zero. Okay. So this is for the finite system when I send B to zero. And it's simply because I have finite system, so I can, although however tiny the probability of flipping spins down, all the spins down is small, it will happen eventually, right? So that's why I'm actually oscillating between this and that. So now the second limit, so the limit two is that I first take the thermodynamic limit, so I send N to infinity first, which is called thermodynamic limit. Limit, thermodynamic limit. And then you send B to zero. But of course, if I send N to infinity first, then that exponential is exponentially suppressed, so I get ratio equal to zero. Okay, so if you first take N goes to infinity, you find that the ratio is zero. And so what it means is that if I, you know, have infinite system and I switch the magnetic field there, the system will stay in that magnetization forever. Okay, it will not be able to flip down. It just stays there. Okay, so the system remains in the state with non-trivial M with M forever. Okay. So, well, what have we just derived? We just derived, and of course, this is what you would call a phase transition, right? So then we have non-trivial magnetization here. This is the true ferromagnetic phase. So this is our ferromagnetic phase. Okay. So what we just derived is that actually phase transitions, in fact, they only make sense in the thermodynamic limit if the system is infinitely large. Only if the system is infinitely large, I can really change the phase. I can really develop a non-trivial ferromagnet. If the system, on the other hand, is of finite size, then there will always be teeny tiny probability that I flip everything down, and average on time, I will have zero magnetization. Okay, so the conclusion from here, although this is super simple demonstration of this fact, and of course you can develop much more involved proofs of the statement, but the statement is true. So the statement is that, strictly speaking, phases and phase transitions are only sharply defined defined for infinite systems or in thermodynamic limit. If you have finite size systems, well, you can stay in that ferromagnetic phase for some time, but eventually, actually, that magnetization disappears, and then the other magnetization appears, and in average, you have only paramagnetic phase. Okay, so this is an important conclusion, and is the importance of the thermodynamic limit. Of course, it will be you know, it's extremely improbable if you have large systems that are, you know, having been in this phase here, in the ferromagnetic phase, you suddenly break that. But it will eventually happen. So for example, as I'm standing here, I'm a large system, probably larger than I should be. And then, you know, there is a teeny tiny probability that all my atoms will suddenly jump to some other phase, and then I will completely disappear, right? But because I'm quite large, I'm almost in the thermodynamic limit, and you know, this phase of the matter is almost stable. Okay? So the macroscopic systems, the real macroscopic systems, are not exactly in the thermodynamic limit, and it's not infinite, but it's quite large. And so they have just long timescales. So, you know, hopefully it will not happen now when I dissolve completely, but only after 1 minute. Are there any questions about this? So this is how you should understand the phase transitions, is that, you know, they only happen in the thermodynamic limit, strictly speaking, but of course for macroscopic bodies, they will exist for a sufficiently long time to really, you know, measure the properties of the phase and really enjoy the phase. Okay. Very good. So these are like very important points about phase transitions. And as you see, you can just demonstrate it by this super simple example. All right. So now, as I said, you know, this Ising model demonstrates this ferromagnetic paramagnetic phase transition. And we would like to understand what's happening at the critical point and, you know, how physical quantities are happening. So in other words, what are the critical exponents and, you know, why they are the same for different matter. So that would be the goal. And so the first approximation how to actually do this is called mean field theory. And so mean field theory offers, you know, the first approximation to solving this model. So of course we know that we can solve this model in 1D exactly. In 2D, it's still possible, but in 3D, it's not possible. So let's consider that maybe we are actually thinking about the 3D model, and let's develop an approximation which should capture some basic features of the solution of the phase transition here. Okay, so now let's talk about mean field theory approximation. So a few words in general what it is. So mean field theory approximation and so the idea is super simple, is that if you look at this Hamiltonian, you have two-body interactions here. You always spins interacting with other spins and whatever. In more complicated Hamiltonians, you can have three-body interactions, four-body interactions, whatever, right? So you can have many-body interactions in principle, but here at least we have two-body interactions. And, you know, solve systems with such interactions is quite complicated. Okay, so what you do instead is that you say, well, these two spins actually don't interact with each other directly. Rather, what this spin does is that it develops some influence, some field at this position I. Okay? And so then I will describe the interaction as the interaction of the spin I with this field produced by this spin. Of course, there will be also a field from this guy, and from this guy. So I will say that there is some average field, molecule average field, mean field, at this point I, and then the spin I interacts only with this average mean field. Okay? So the idea is to replace many body interactions with one body interaction function with an average. With an average or mean field, which is produced by the other bodies. So produced by other bodies. Okay, so that's the idea of the mean field theory. It's super simple, right? I just, you know, replace all two-body interactions of this spin with anything else here, so this, whatever. I just, you know, say all these spins around my field I, they just produce a mean field, which has some value here at the position I, and I just interact with sigma I with that mean field. Okay, so that's the idea of mean field theory. So in practice, what it actually means, so in practice, like this, what it means is that you actually take your Hamiltonian, how many interactions it has, and then you expand it in fluctuations, and you neglect all the fluctuations. Okay, so in practice, you do the expansion of the Hamiltonian in fluctuations, and you neglect all of them. So you expand the Hamiltonian in fluctuations and take just the leading order. So no fluctuations, basically. Order. No fluctuations whatsoever. And that will be your Hamiltonian in the mean field theory approximation. Okay, so let me just demonstrate this. Well, this is just very vague. So let me just demonstrate that for the Ising model. For example, for the Ising. So we have the Hamiltonian. And we consider our interacting variables are the spins sigma I. Okay. So then what you want to do is that you want to write the sigma I as sigma I minus average of sigma I plus average of sigma I. So average of sigma I is our magnetization. Okay. So average of sigma I is just 1 over n sigma j. So that's our magnetization. So basically, we are expanding the actual value of the spin, let's say up, with respect to the average value of sigma I in the lattice. Okay, so then you call this thing here the fluctuation, and then this is just the average value. So this is the fluctuation. And then, so we have sigma I is basically fluctuation plus sigma I. But of course, throwing away the fluctuation is that, yeah, basically replace sigma I with the mean field. Okay, so let's do it. So we have our Hamiltonian, so which has sigma I, sigma j. So then sigma I, sigma j is of course this thing here. So it is sigma I minus m plus m, which is the epsilon, and then sigma j minus m plus m, which is the epsilon. And of course, you expand this as sigma I minus m, sigma j minus m, and then plus m sigma I, sigma j, minus m squared. Okay, so this is what it is. If I use some algebraic formula, okay. And so this is the fluctuation. That is the fluctuation. So this is fluctuation square, epsilon square. And you throw that away. So you disregard that term. And then you see that whatever is remaining left is simply an interaction of the spin with some mean field M. Okay? So this is how you do it. So then the Hamiltonian in the mean field theory approximation is just H is minus 1/2. And then sum over I and j, over I and j. But now I just use this thing here, so I neglect that term. So neglect the term with epsilon square. And I just have m sigma I plus sigma j minus m square. Okay. And I'm still forgetting Gij. So that's our Hamiltonian, how it looks like in the mean field theory approximation. Okay, so now some dirty trick. So these are the interactions between the spins I and j. These are the coupling constants or whatever. Okay, so now, for example, in the second term, you see that I'm summing over I and j of this Gij. Okay, so let's do it gradually. So first, let's define something ji tilde to be sum over j of jij. So I'm fixing the index I, so I'm fixing my spin here, and then I sum over its possible neighbors, okay? So this thing better be finite if I have a finite range of interaction. So this is something which, you know, if I go to infinity and all these things, all these guys are non-trivial, then I'll get infinity. But if I have only nearest neighbors, or second nearest neighbors, or third nearest neighbors, this is just a number, okay? This number, in principle, depends on the position in the lattice. Okay, so it depends on, this is the fifth spin, this is the sixth spin, this is the seventh spin. But of course, the lattice is uniform. So actually, every point in the lattice should be equivalent to any other point in the lattice, right? I don't consider the endpoints. The endpoints typically don't play any role. So then if this is actually true for, so this should be true for any point in the lattice. And so that's why I can set this equal to bj without index I, because every point in the lattice is the same. Okay, so this is independent of j, independent of I, because the lattice is, I can do translations in the lattice and nothing happens. The lattice is uniform. So then it's great because, for example, if I'm looking at this second term, sum over ij, m squared jij, well, if I do one sum, I just get this capital J without any index. If I do the other sum, I just pick up number n. Okay, so this is then, okay, so let's see. So it's minus 1/2 m squared, so it's plus 1/2 m squared, and I pick up J. And I pick up the number n, so that's what the second term gives me. And then, of course, here I am summing over sigma I. Okay, so if I do the sum over j, so let's take this term here. Okay, this is complicated. But anyway, let's take this term here, sigma I, jij. So I can do the sum over j first. If I do the sum over j first, this becomes j, but this is still sigma I. So then I have just simply sum over I of sigma I. If I do the same thing with j, but do the sum over I first, then I'll get the same term. So this is okay. So these are actually the two same terms, of course, they must be. And so this is minus 1/2. So let's do it gradually. So it's sum over ij, m, sigma I, jij, 1/2 is gone because we have the same terms. And then if I do the sum over j first, and I have just j here. And if I do the sum over I, well, okay, so this is what it is. And it's even correct. M sigma I, mj sigma I, yeah, that's right. So this is the Hamiltonian in the mean field theory approximation. And you really see that we replaced, by neglecting the fluctuations, we replaced these two-body interactions with one-body interactions where my spin, sigma I, just interacts with the mean field now. with the average field. Everybody happy? Reasonably happy. All right, so that's our approximation. So now, of course, what you want to do is that you want to solve what really Eisen model gives you in this approximation. So you want to solve for everything. So you need to use, so this is your Hamiltonian, and then you want to use the thermodynamic machinery, the statistical physics machinery, to calculate what the partition function is, what the free energy is, and what are the physical quantities of this system. So now let's use this H to calculate properties of Ising model. And so the first step, so now use the statistical physics machinery on this approximation Hamiltonian. And so the first step is to calculate the partition function. So that is exactly the same thing as you were doing yesterday, but easier. That's why it's presented in the lecture. And the difficult calculation you do in tutorial. Of course, you know, so that's over all possible configurations of spins, which is the same thing as yesterday. So it's sum over sigma 1, sum over sigma 2, sum over sigma 3. But now our H is just linear in this sigma I instead of quadratic. Okay, so this is just a product in the same way as you had it yesterday. So I can write it as a product of sums sigma I equals 2 plus minus 1. That's a product of sums. And then exponential, and then minus beta h, where h is this thing here. So it's beta mj sum over j sigma j as the term which is linear in sigma, and then minus 1/2 beta mj m square, which is the first term. Okay. So of course, this term is just a constant. I can take it out of the exponential. And because you have, OK, so this is equal to e to minus nj m square divided by 2 t, as the, just putting the second term, which is constant, out of the sum. And then I can write it as a product. And you see that because this is linear in sigma j, it's always one sum contributing. So this is a sum of many terms in the exponential, but they all depend on different sigma. So actually, I can always, you know, choose the sigma which I'm summing over. And so it will just be product of these exponentials with that given sigma. So it's I 1 to n, and then sigma sum over sigma I plus minus 1. And then e to m j sigma I over t. Okay. I was just picking the corresponding sigma which I'm summing over. But the whole thing, because I have sum in the exponential, it will be product of these sums. All right. Okay, and so we arrived, of course. I can do this thing easily. It's just plus exponential of plus this thing here, plus exponential is minus this thing here, which gives you a cosine h of the argument. And I have n of those, so it'll be cosine h to the power n. And so your partition function is just e to minus nj m squared over 2t. And then 2 cosine h of mj over t to the power n. Okay, everybody happy with this calculation? It's the same calculation you have done yesterday, but much easier than what you have done yesterday, because I just have a linear term. Well, that's the partition function. Of course, once you know the partition function, you calculate the free energy, log zap. Okay. So I have to just take a logarithm of this thing here and multiply by the temperature. And if I done this correctly, this should just give me, for example, taking a logarithm of the first term brings me 1 over t, but I multiply by t. That will be just njm square over 2. So njm square over 2 comes from this term. And then I will have plus minus and t and coming from here, and then logarithm of 2 times the sine h mj over t. Okay, so that's the free energy. Very good. So now what we want to do is that we want to find the equilibrium configuration. Okay, so in particular, we are interested in, you know, what happens, let's say, at a given temperature. What is the magnetization of the system? Okay, so what we will do now is that, and of course, you know that this is your thermodynamic potential. And so what you want to find is a minimum of the potential at given circumstances. So the equilibrium at given T. At given temperature will simply be given by the minimum of F of the free energy. Well, the free energy depends on a number of sides, and we will not be changing that, on some coupling constant J. And then the magnetization, of course, that will be eventually a function of temperature. I want to find how the magnetization looks like a function of temperature. So for a given temperature, I want to find a minimum of F with respect to the magnetization. So that's what we want to do. So what we are after is just calculating dF over dm. Okay. The first term is easy, njm. And then the second term gives me nj. And so I have to differentiate logarithm of cosine h. So differential of logarithm is 1 over cosine h. And then if you differentiate cosine h, it gives you sine h. So it gives you tangens of h. Okay, so it's tangens h, nj tangens h, mj over t. Okay, so this is what you get by differentiation of the free energy with respect to m, and this better be equal to 0, okay, at the equilibrium. So in other words, you are getting nice recursion relation m. So now we can cancel nj, and you have m is tangens h, mj over t. What this gives you is how m looks like as a function of temperature. It's an implicit relation m of t. So now if you take your Mathematica, you can plot this directly. And of course, what you should get is you'll find something like this. It's 0, and then it's non-zero here, depending on whether you are above the critical temperature or below the critical temperature. So now, however, I don't see any critical temperature here. The only thing I see is mj and t. Okay. So actually, what it means is that j has to be somehow related to the critical temperature. So how do I see that? Is that you can actually, as I said, you can plot it explicitly in Mathematica or Maple, but you can also use the old beautiful analytical methods where you plot left-hand side and you plot right-hand side, and you see where they intersect. So immediately you see that you are comparing. So we have two possibilities. We just look at what's happening. So I want to plot left-hand side with respect to the right-hand side. So left-hand side is just linear in M. So it looks like this. Okay. And now I want to intersect it with the tangents H. Okay. And of course, tangents H looks like this. And so now the question is, what is the slope of tangents H at zero? We have two possibilities. One possibility is that the tangents H looks like this. So this is M. This is tangents H of MJ over T. And so the only intersection in this case would be at M equal to zero. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is that the tangents H is actually growing faster. So then this is your linear thing. But now your tangents H looks like this. Okay, so now this is the tangents H, MJ over T. And this is your M. And then you have three solutions. You have the solution here, but you have also the solution here and the solution there. Okay, so then the question is, which case happens? And these are the two cases which can happen. So to that, you need to know how tangents H behaves close to zero. And then compare the slope of tangents H at this point here, right? Either it's bigger or it's smaller. So tangents H of X, so tangents H of X is something like X plus other things. So in other words, this behaves like MJ over T plus other things. In other words, you are interested in the ratio J over T, which tells you which case happens. So if J over T is bigger than 1, then we are in this situation. If it's more than 1, we are in that situation. So where are we? We are here. So this thing here happens when J is smaller than T. And this thing here happens when J is bigger than T. Of course, the border case is when J equals to T. That's precisely when you start developing a non-trivial magnetization from zero. But what it actually tells you is that J is the critical temperature. And if you are at temperatures which are bigger than the critical temperature, the only solution for the magnetization is that of zero. So this describes the paramagnetic phase. Whereas if you are in temperatures which are smaller than critical temperature, then you can have non-trivial magnetization, this one and that one here. And so this is the ferromagnetic phase. You again see that both things are possible. You can have plus magnetization or minus magnetization or even zero magnetization, but the zero one will be unstable. If you are in infinite thermodynamic limit, this will happen or that will happen, but it will stay forever. If you are not exactly at thermodynamic limit, the system will jump from this one to that one and back in some long time scales. All right, so we just described this thing here. And of course, now you can play with the temperature and you read what the value of the magnetization is. So for given T, I find this intersection. For bigger T, I find a different intersection. And so you can reproduce exactly this figure
by just doing these analytical methods. For given T, I find this magnetization. For different T, I find that magnetization. And that's the painful way how you plot this thing here. Of course, you can directly plot this thing if you have made law mathematical. All right, so that's how you do it. So now I told you that we are interested not only, you know, at finding the critical temperature, but also about the behavior of physical quantities near this critical point. So one physical quantity is obvious, it's the order parameter m. So now I'm interested in how m starts developing around Tc. Okay? So you see that because this is continuous phase transition, m is super small here. Okay, so it starts developing from zero and smoothly develops to some value. So now how does it develop? So what is, you know, what is the behavior of m close to the critical point? And that's described by one of the critical exponents. So now which one do I need? Well, maybe I need a picture. And you can get that critical exponent by looking at the formula which we already have, which is the formula of the free energy. Okay, so let's calculate. So now let's find the behavior of order parameter m close to critical point. You see? Are there any questions? I'm going quite fast. Is this okay, or everybody happy so far?
I have a question. So the way we define J is just the sum over the interaction matrix of one.
That's right.
You were saying that turns out to be the critical temperature.
That's exactly right. So you know, if you just do this mean field theory approximation, this J, which we define by this way, turns out to be exactly the critical temperature. So now this is only in the mean field theory approximation. So the reality will probably be close, and may not exactly be the case, right? But yeah, so they basically gives you the physical interpretation of your coupling constant J, right? So it gives you somewhere close to critical temperature, that's the value of the coupling J. Other questions? Okay, so we want to find the behavior of the outer parameter m close to Tc, but we know that m is small.
So m is small here because we have a continuous phase transition.
Okay, so what you can do is that you can take this free energy, which is quite ugly, so f, which you calculated here, and expand it for small m. Okay, so take the free energy, people actually consider free energy per unit site. So it's that thing over there. So it's Jm square over 2 minus t logarithm to the sine h and j over t. Okay, and then you expand that in Taylor series in small m. Okay, and so what you find, well, I skip one step. You have to believe me. Anyway, you have to expand cosine h, and then you have to expand logarithm. So that's non-trivial, so let's just write the result. So what you find is, of course, the result depends on j, coupling constant, but we know that j is just critical temperature, at least in our approximation. So instead of J, I'll be writing Tc. Okay, so what you find that is Tc over 2, and then J Tc minus T, and then the first term actually becomes the quadratic term in M. So there's, you know, you don't have any absolute term, and then the first term in the Taylor series is quadratic, and the next term, so linear term is missing, absolute term is missing, cubic term is missing, but the next term is what is that? Quartic, Tc to power 4, 12 n cube, m to the 4, and then you find corrections of m to the 6. Okay,
if I'm just expanding in small m, the free energy, which is given over there, but free energy per lattice side, then you find that the first term is just quadratic in m, and then the next term is quartic in m, and then you have some high order corrections. Okay, so that's great. So now, of course, you can plot this depending on whether you are bigger than Tc or smaller than Tc. Okay, if you are bigger than Tc, just do a super small picture. Maybe we can plot it here. Everybody remembers this picture, okay? So, you know, just to get an intuition, you can plot this thing here. And if you are at t bigger than Tc, t bigger than Tc, then this term, whatever stands in front of m square, is actually positive. And of course, this is positive. Okay? So then you have positive plus positive is boring. Okay? So that's boring. So this is your free energy. Free energy as a function of m. And it's boring. Okay? It's basically something which is quadratic, but something which is quartic, and they add together and it's boring. But if you are at t smaller than Tc, then this term now here is actually negative. So this is still positive, but this is negative. So if this is negative, of course, close to zero, it's this thing which is winning, right? So I go first negative. And then for larger m, this will dominate, and I will become positive. OK, so this is more interesting. And then you first go negative, and then you go positive. Here you go negative, and here you go positive. So this is f of m, and this is m. And of course, what it corresponds to precisely is that we are finding that the global minimum of the free energy is 0 in the paramagnetic phase. And it's either 0, which you see that actually it's maximum, that's why it's unstable. But it's this thing here, it's minus m0 or plus m0, which corresponds to this global minimum here in the ferromagnetic phase. So this is precisely how you see these solutions emerging by studying the free energy. Okay, so this is how you see. But all this is just in the vicinity of critical temperature, just in the vicinity of the critical point. So now, the same way, we want to study how the magnetization looks like in the close to the critical point. So we do exactly the same thing. So now, as we were doing before, we are differentiating f with respect to m, set it equal to 0, and find how the magnetization looks like. But now, this is simplified because our f is just quadratic term plus a quartic term here. So now we do exactly the same thing. We do df over dm, set it equal to 0. And then we're just keeping these two terms here. And we find that m, just do it yourself, it's one line, behaves like 3 1 minus t over tc. And then plus minus that. Okay. So anyway, what it means is that introducing this new quantity, small t, which is t minus tc divided by tc, so really how close in temperature I am close to the critical temperature, well, you see that this is tc minus t divided by tc. So this behaves like minus t to some power beta. What is that power beta? Huh? 1/2. Very good. This is the square root, right? So beta is 1/2. So we just predicted that the magnetization or the order parameter, well, vanishes close to the critical temperature as a square root of this quantity small t. Okay, and so that's first of the critical exponents. So beta is the first critical exponent, and it describes how the order parameter behaves close to the critical temperature. All right. So now you know first critical exponent, beta. So now there is many more of these, and of course they are about other properties of the system close to the critical point. So one of the properties is the specific heat. How does it look like close to the critical point? Another one is how does the susceptibility, which is like a response to the magnetic field, behave close to the critical point, and so on. So there are other critical exponents. I'm not going to calculate, but I'm going to give you the result. Other critical exponents. I will just give you the definition. So one critical exponent is the behavior of the specific heat. So how the specific heat behaves as a function of t. Okay, let's put absolute value t. So that it's obvious that this is positive. And definition of the critical exponent alpha is how much the specific heat diverges at the critical point. Okay? We already know that the magnetization behaves like T to power beta, so it's how much the magnetization vanishes as you approach the critical point. Then there's a susceptibility, which is basically how the magnetization depends on the external magnetic field. So susceptibility is what it is dm over dB. And how this behaves is actually T to minus critical exponent gamma. Another one is that if you are exactly at t equal to tc, so all these things, alpha, beta, and gamma, are as you approach tc. So now another one is that, let's say I'm exactly at tc, but I have external magnetic field. So, you know, what is the value of the magnetization there? So then, you know, how B behaves as a function of magnetization exactly at tc, and that defines the critical exponent delta. So we have alpha, beta, gamma, delta. You think you can go, what is the next letter after delta?
Epsilon.
Epsilon? I don't. Is that correct? Delta, epsilon, probably. Okay. So the next critical exponent is actually mu. Or nu. Or eta. All right. So there are other critical exponents, so these are really the thermodynamic ones, which you can get from thermodynamic considerations. But if you know the microscopics, you can ask also what is the correlation function between spin and spin. So if you have spin here and spin very, very far away, are they correlated? Are they both up? Okay, so there is a spin-spin correlation function.
Spin-spin correlation function.
And you will see that you know it from field theory if you have taken a field theory. So if you have distance between the spins, which is r, then this thing will behave like the exponential of minus r over psi. And then there may be r, if you are in d dimensions, d minus 2 plus eta. So psi here. So this is how you know how the spins are correlated. So xi is called correlation length. Okay, and so the correlation length is basically describing is if you have blocks, so as you approach the critical point, you start developing in your system blocks of ordered spins. So you have a huge block where all the spins are up, okay, as you approach the critical temperature. Okay, so now the size of this block is basically what xi is. So this is what xi means, is the correlation length. So all these spins are correlated in that block. And then you will have a huge block with the spins down, and so on. Okay, so the xi is basically the average value of the ordered blocks, the average size of the ordered blocks. So now, as you approach the critical point, this correlation length actually diverges. So in other words, everything of the size of the system will be correlated. Okay, so you have huge, super huge blocks, which are of the size of the system that are correlated. And that's captured by the critical exponent nu, so not epsilon. and so the correlation length diverges here. Finally, the last critical exponent is this exponent eta, and it's called anomalous dimension. Basically, what you would expect on the dimensional analysis that the correlation length, well, should behave like r 1 over r to d minus 2. Okay, so this is what you would expect, but that's not what happens. There may be a correction to that through this eta. What it means is that somebody mentioned that yesterday, is that at the critical point, your dimension is not the full dimension, but it's actually a fractal dimension. So this anomalous dimension is related to the fractal structure which you start developing at the critical point. Okay, so this is basically departure from the whole dimension. Okay, so now we have all these critical exponents, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, eta, and nu here. And they can all be calculated in this mean field theory approximation. Okay, and so if you do that, you find these memorable results, which I don't remember. So what are they? So alpha is equal to something. Alpha is equal to 0. Alpha equals to 0. Beta equals to 1/2, which we calculated here. Gamma equals to 1. Delta equals to 3. Eta equals to 0. And nu equals to 1/2. Okay, so that's the prediction of the mean field theory. Mean field theory prediction. All right, so that's amazing. So we just predicted how all the quantities for our ferromagnetic paramagnetic phase transition will actually behave close to the critical point, and this is our theoretical prediction. Notice that this, you know, the mean field theory approximation which we have done here, I told you, well, think about the three-dimensional system. But in fact, the dimension of the system never enters anywhere. So the D, the dimensionality of the cubic lattice, never showed up here, okay? So this is a prediction of the mean field theory irrespective of the value of perspective of the value D. So in particular, this should be true in three dimensions, two dimensions, but also in one dimension. All right. So now you should tell me, wait a minute. You are describing a phase transition in one dimension. We showed yesterday that there is no phase transition in one dimension because the free energy is actually analytic in one dimension. Of course, what it means is that this description is completely wrong in one dimension. Okay, so the mean field theory approximation completely breaks down. So the lower dimension you are, this is more wrong. Okay, so this is a general prediction for any dimension, and it will be true in four dimensions, but it will be almost true for three dimensions,
rather wrong for two dimensions and completely wrong in one dimension. And because we neglected fluctuations. Okay, so this is because we neglected fluctuations. This is wrong in small d. So if you are in t equal to one dimension, this is completely wrong because you predicted everything nice about the phase transition, but there is no phase transition whatsoever. In two dimensions, well, there is a phase transition, but these exponents are wrong. In three dimensions, they are slightly better, but still wrong. In four dimensions, this will be correct. Was there a question? Yes.
Isn't there also an importance in the value of g? Because we say that we sum over all interactions.
You mean j?
J, sorry.
That's right. That's right. So also, you know, if you consider that's a very good question. So, for example, if you consider actually infinite range of interactions, means your theory will be true even in one dimension. If you have infinite range of interactions, even in 1D, you have a phase transition. Okay, so it's also what is important is the range of the interactions. Very good. So anyway, so we have the yeah.
Is there not a D in the G?
Is there no D in the G here? Yeah, there's D here.
Okay.
But this is the number of dimensions you are in. But I'm saying that the values of these alpha, beta, gamma, delta, whatever, they are d-independent.
Oh.
That's what I'm saying. And also what I'm saying is that, you know, this seems to go through. Of course, I can plug here, can I? D equal to 1. Well, it depends what eta is, but yeah. All right. So that's the beautiful prediction. And so we got it basically by considering the expansion of the free energy close to the critical point. So now he comes Landau, and he says, well, this is the basic feature of every continuous phase transition. I can just take a free energy, which will be an expansion in my order parameter, and there will be some coefficient here. So I have something m square, something m4, and that's all I need to do to predict these exponents. Okay, so where does this prescription for the free energy come from? Well, he says, well, we derived it in some complicated way here. But that's not what you have to do, he says. All you need to know about the phase transition is the symmetry of the Hamiltonian. The symmetry of the Hamiltonian is that I can go from sigma to minus sigma. So in other words, you know, only quadratic quantities will not see this change. So that's why I cannot have term linear in M or cubic in M or whatever. So I am respecting the symmetry sigma to minus sigma. So M to minus M. So he's saying all you need to know, so Landau's theory is basically saying Landau saying, well, my free energy has to look like something like m square plus something like m to the 4 because of the symmetry. But he's also saying in order to have a phase transition, this term better change signs as I cross tc. Okay, so this something here has to be proportional to small t, so it changes sign when I cross tc. And then he develops a theory where he says, well, for any system, I can just study the symmetry. I can study what the outer parameter is. Then I just immediately write down what the free energy is. And then I predict everything I need to know about the phase transition. Okay, so you will do it in your tutorial today. You will study Landau's theory, and you will derive these results, which I'm stating here, from the Landau's theory. Okay. So the theory is beautiful. It predicts universality classes. It predicts that the water is the same as ferromagnet. It gives you everything, but it gives you the wrong critical exponents. Okay, so everything is beautiful. It all works perfectly well, but this is wrong. So then you have to do lots of work to actually correct it. And that's where the renormalization group comes in. So the first step is to actually say, well, what we have neglected is the fluctuations of the mean field. We said that the mean field is everywhere the same in the lattice. But however, we neglected the fluctuations. So the first step is to actually add fluctuations to this. So you can consider a term, nabla m square. So I'm adding a term with the fluctuations of m. Suddenly this thing is not an expression for the free energy, but it's an expression for Landau-Ginzburg function. Okay, so from here, if you include fluctuations, you go to a field theory where your M can fluctuate, spatially fluctuate, and then you have Landau-Ginzburg function. Then you apply the normalization group technique on this, and then you do small epsilon expansion around the exact form of the mean field theory, which is in four dimensions. So you do 4 minus epsilon expansion, where epsilon is small. Okay, and then you arrive at Wilsonian prediction, and you arrive at almost correct critical exponents for ferromagnet and for water. Okay, so if you're interested in this, you can watch my lectures from 2 years ago. But what I promised to Pedro is I promised that I will tell you about mean field theory, I will tell you about the critical exponents, and hopefully that will be enough for his course. So if you are interested in renormalization group techniques, watch my course. If you are not, just this is all you need to know, hopefully, for Pedro's course. So let me stop here.